Hi everyone, welcome to The Intense Mind, a podcast for intense people. My name is Emmy and I'm here with you to learn and grow from gifted and intense minds around the world. Today we're talking to Amy Yip. Amy is a mental fitness coach and the author of the book Unfinished Business, Breaking Down the Great War Between Adult Child and Immigrant Parents. In this conversation, Amy talks about her life and how it was deeply affected by her immigrant parents' struggles and the sacrifice that they've made. She shared stories about growing up with cultural expectations and trying to make her parents proud. Her story as the child of immigrant parents really highlighted the complex dynamics of these relationships. Growing up, she felt the pressure of her parents' sacrifices and expectations, which led her to feel like she was not good enough and needing to always prove herself. As Amy explored her story, she discovers the impact of intergenerational trauma and the importance of empathy and understanding in the healing journey. She also discussed her career changes and how she discovered more about herself. As a mental fitness coach now, she tells us how she worked through intergenerational trauma and built confidence. Throughout this conversation, we explore topics like unresolved grief and the emotional process of self-discovery. Hopefully, you'll learn as much from this conversation as I did. Now to Amy.
Hi, Amy. Nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm really glad to have you. Today, I would like to get to know more about you and your unique experience with immigrant parents and how that has affected you. But usually, the conversation just takes on its own life. So let's see how it goes.
Yeah, that sounds good.
First of all, can you tell us a little more about yourself?
Yeah, so I was born in the U.S. and my parents came to the U.S. I think it was like in 1978, and they came with $1,700 in their pockets. And when they came, they had to leave their two young kids back in Hong Kong. So my middle sister was two. The older one was seven. I was not yet in the picture when they came to America.
Oh, all right. So you were the youngest? Yeah.
I am the youngest, and I was also the accident. So when my parents came to the U.S., they came for two key reasons. One is what a lot of immigrants come to America for. It is to give their children a better chance, that American dream, a different opportunity. And the second reason they came to America is because my middle sister, who was two at the time, had a hole in her heart. And the doctors in Hong Kong...
So it's medically required.
Yeah, and the doctors in Hong Kong couldn't do much for her. And so they needed to come here, survive, set the foundations here so that they could bring her here to get medical care. And when they got on that plane, they didn't know, will she survive while we're gone? Like, are we actually going to make it in time? And so it could have been the last time that they saw her, you know, and I can't imagine that because I have a 2-year-old right now. And to think I'm going to leave him behind, might never see him, like, you know, the pain of that. So they came to America to try to set the foundation. And then while being here, my mom got pregnant with me.
Oh, God.
And so she goes to my dad and she's like, what do we do? You know, we're trying to make things work. And here's, you know, I'm pregnant again. And my dad was very, very traditional Chinese man, wants a son.
So is that where they're from, Hong Kong?
They're originally from right outside of Shanghai.
Already moved once.
Yes, my dad is from Shanghai. My mom was from a village outside of Shanghai. So they had, my dad snuck into Hong Kong when he was really young, like took boats and trains and snuck up in the dark in the hills. And my mom was, had legal paperwork to go to Hong Kong, and they met in Hong Kong. Yeah. And so, you know, when my mom told my dad, hey, I'm pregnant, my dad said, you know what? I've already got two daughters. I've always wanted a son because, you know, like he really wanted a son to carry the family name. So he said, let's keep it. And so they decided to keep me. And they always joke that at the hospital, when I came out, my dad fainted. And he jokes that he fainted because, oh, no, a third daughter. So, yeah, that's a little about about my history and my parents immigrating here.
What was it like hearing that story? It's almost as though you were not very welcomed, just from what you've described.
Yeah, that's a very, like, you're on point, because growing up hearing that, and my dad used to always joke, oh, you can't, because I was a month early, and he's like, you were a month early, so that's why that part of you didn't grow, you know, the boy part. So I was like, oh, okay. And he used to always cut my hair like a boy, and I always felt like I should have been the boy. So I always grew up thinking, like, I tried to be the boy. I was a tomboy when I was a kid. I played sports. I'm like, I don't play with girls. And there was this pressure, because I felt like I was already a disappointment because I was the girl, you know, so there was need to prove that I was worthy enough throughout my childhood and into adulthood.
The boy part just sounds horrible.
Yeah. And nowadays, I joke with my dad all the time. Like, you know, he adores us. He loves us. And I always joke, like, you wouldn't, because I'm very affectionate. So I hug and I kiss, and he loves it, pretends not to, but he loves it. And I tell him, if I were a son, you wouldn't be getting this, you know, and I'm the best surprise. And he's like, yeah. So it's a very different relationship. But growing up, I didn't understand that, you know, like, even if I'm not a boy, they still love me a lot.
You have been very generous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you consider yourself having struggled with what psychologists call intergenerational trauma? Or how would you describe your experience? Because that's a very specific, yet you're not alone in that at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to start by explaining how I think about what intergenerational trauma is, just
Please
because there's
do.
So many definitions out there. And the way that I look at intergenerational trauma, and through my own research and training, is
and actually
that
it might be useful to tell our audience what you do.
Oh, yeah. So
sorry to interrupt.
Let's get that. No, that's a great point. So a bit about, you know, my upbringing influenced my whole life. I was this, I'm going to work hard, achieve. And I was constantly like, didn't sleep, you know, like that was my life. Get the A plus, not the A. A is not good enough. Like, that was my life. Right. And so my career, I spent 16 years in corporate America. I started as a tech consultant at Booz Allen Hamilton. And then I went back to school, got another degree, went into brand management at Clorox. And then my last corporate job was at Google, and I spent 5 years there. And
they're all hardcore corporates.
Very hardcore corporates. I was burnt out. I was hospitalized many times from overwork and stress and burnout. And eventually, I became a coach, and my journey into becoming a coach was actually, it's a great story. So I'm going to share this story. And it was, when I started at Google, I had always said, I have dreams to see the world, to travel, to give back, volunteer. And I want to do that before I settle down. Right. And so when I started at Google, I said, max amount of time I'm going to stay here is 5 years. And then I'm going to go do this thing. What I didn't realize at the time was, as a woman in your mid 30s, you have a lot of big decisions you have to be making. So I turned, I was in my mid 30s when I was at Google. For one, my career at Google was going really well. And my dad was going around bragging about me working at
of
Google.
Course.
You know,
it's Google.
Like, so when I even mentioned the fact that, oh, I might leave, he's like, what? What are you thinking? But my career was going well, and everyone's like, why would you leave? Everyone's trying to get in. Then I got a husband during that time. I was single at first when I started, and husbands change plans when you have a partner, right? And the biggest thing that happened during that time was everyone was saying, you should have babies. You know, someone said, your eggs are rotting. You're hitting your mid 30s. You need to start having kids, because if you don't do it now, you might never be able to have kids. And so that put a lot of pressure on my husband and I. But Google has this great benefit to do IVF. So we had our embryos frozen. And, you know, we're like, great, we're going to freeze our embryos. That's our backup plan. And we could still go travel, volunteer, and then come back and use them. thing is, a year later, we found out that the tank where our embryos were stored, the like freezer tank thing, lost temperature control. And so they essentially said, we can't tell you the viability anymore. We don't know if it's good or not. It's like if you had meat in your fridge and your fridge loses temperature. So they're like, until you plan to try it out and use it, we can't tell you. And I'm like, but I wasn't going to try it using it until later, you know? And so that was when I hit my rock bottom point. And I went on a self-help journey and try to figure out, like, what is it that I really want? Because on the outside, everything was great. I have this great job. I have a wonderful family, you know, wonderful husband, great friends. So why am I complaining? So I felt a bit guilty and shameful for doing that. But on the inside, it's like something just felt off. But because I was raised in a very traditional Chinese household, you want to save face. You don't air your dirty laundry. I started with reading books because I'm like, I can't tell the world that things aren't great. So I'm going to read books and figure it out myself. Books didn't work. I read for 8 months, every book out there. Learned a lot of good stuff, but not do I have settled down, have babies, or do I go pursue my dream? And so a good friend, have you ever heard about ayahuasca?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So for those who are listening who don't know what ayahuasca is, it's a medicinal plant. In Peru, they give it to you for clarity and cleansing of the soul. It's an earth plant. And so a really good friend told me, there's this thing, it's called ayahuasca. It's supposed to give you clarity. And I said, oh, that's what I need. I need clarity. And so I went to Peru, 5-day ayahuasca ceremony to try to figure out what to do. I got a lot of clarity on life. Right. But not on the thing that I needed the answer to, which is, do I settle and have babies or do I go travel the world? And then when I got back to the US, a coworker told me about coaching. I didn't know what coaching was. And I was honestly skeptical. Like, how could someone who doesn't know me help me figure out the answers? But I was also desperate because I'm running out of time. And so I hired a coach, and it was the best thing I did because she helped me to figure out what really matters to me at my core. Not what everyone else is saying I should want or who I should be, but really, what do I want? And I realized two things. One is, even if I stay, I'm not in control of if I can have kids or not. You know, it's just not something that, even though as much as we want to control it, we don't have control. But I do have control of whether I pursue my dreams, and I'll regret it if I don't. So I made the decision, I'm going to go off and, you know, we're going to go travel, we're going to go volunteer, and we're going to go live out the thing we've always wanted to do. And then the second thing I decided was, I want to be a coach, because it sucks being stuck and feeling like you have nobody to talk to about it. And so I got my certification. And then in January of 2020, sold everything, left my job at Google, and my husband and I took a one-way flight to Ghana to volunteer at a breast cancer nonprofit. And as you probably remember what happened in 2020, that little thing called COVID came along. We were only going to volunteer for maybe 3 months, but we were stuck there because borders closed. So we were there for 7 months, but it was the best thing because that was where a lot of my growth came. My relationship with my husband shifted a lot, and I built my business there because I had nothing else to do but sit in a little room. And so it was a great gift. And then when borders finally reopened, we started living, working nomadically. And when we turned 40, we're like, you know what, we should probably start trying to have kids. And if not, we'll go home, see if the embryos work. And we start trying. And 2 months later, I got pregnant naturally at age 40. With my little guy. And that's what brought me back to the US. So you know, that's my journey into what I do today. So to answer your question earlier, I'm a mental fitness coach. I work with a lot of people to build their mental fitness, to let go of that trauma, to heal, and to really build the self-confidence to live their own lives the way that they want. And so I do one-on-one coaching. I also work with a lot of organizations and companies to accelerate the growth of their underrepresented groups into leadership. And I recently authored a book called Unfinished Business, Breaking Down the Great Wall Between Adult Child and Immigrant Parents, which is all about my own healing journey with my parents.
How do they find unfinished business?
It is available on all online
How would you
retailers.
define unfinished
Well,
business?
how would I thought you said how would they find? How would I define it? Unfinished business is, I think about it this way. A lot of people tell me about the wishes that they had. And a lot of people say, I wish I spent more time with my parents. I wish I heard their stories. I wish I documented their life. I wish I got a chance to do that again, but they're gone now. And so it feels like it's this unfinished business, right? Where you wish you got to do it, but you don't have that chance anymore. And so for me, one of the things that happened to me when I was coaching, when I was stuck overseas, I was coaching a woman. She's in her mid-50s, Chinese American. And she came to me because she was trying to figure out what do I want to do next in my life. Mind you, she's an executive at one of the largest banks in America, right? And so when we were working together, she discovered I want to do something creative and I want to start my own business. And then she said, oh, but I've got to wait till my father passes away. And I said, why? What makes you believe that? And she said, because when I became, senior vice president, he said, great, the next thing you're going to be is president. And around my dad, I go into little girl mode where I'm so afraid of his criticisms, his judgments, his expectations, his disappointments. I don't want to go there. So she was going to hold off on her dreams, because she was so afraid. And when we talked about, are you willing to have conversations with your dad? She's like, no, I don't want to. I don't want to deal with the criticisms, right? I already know how he's going to respond. And I saw this pattern in a lot of my clients who are children of immigrants, where they feel these expectations and these pressures. And they're like, well, I either have to lie about it or I have to just wait. And what I didn't mention earlier is I actually lied to my parents at first about leaving Google. So, about like quitting and traveling the world, I told my parents I got this amazing job overseas. It would be great for my career. Like, I lied to them. So, and it was my sister that told on me. That was the only reason I was
The
honest.
roots of that is that some kind of survivor guilt or the fear of outshining them? What is
I think it's the pressure that you put, right? Like, the pressure and the guilt. And
the
those are a
pressure
couple
to
of
have
things.
to be very, very good, whatever you do?
And in my book, Unfinished Business, every chapter, I call every chapter a myth. And it's a myth because it's a story we have about our parents. So like the first chapter is myth one, which is like my success will never be good enough for my parents. So it's this belief that so many of us have that no matter what we do, it'll never be enough. Right. And then there's another one of like, I'll never be able to repay my parents for their sacrifices. And part of it is the story and the narrative of, how much suffering they went through to give us what we have. And this belief that we need to somehow repay them for that. And one of the things that my dad said when I interviewed him for the book. So the
You
book, the way it,
interviewed your father for your book. That's amazing.
Yes. So the book is not just my story. So every chapter is a myth. It's a, like one of the chapters is like my parents are disappointed because I married a white guy instead of a good Chinese boy, something like that, right? And so it's all the stories that I had about my relationship with my parents, my stories, my assumptions. And in order to write the book, I spent 40 plus hours over 3 years talking to my parents to hear their side of the story. Because I wanted to understand what is the truth, right? And so every chapter, I share my side of the story, my parents' side of the story. And at the end of the chapter, there's something called a date with your parents. So the reader can go on a date with their own parents to understand where their parents are coming from, their own stories, their histories, their traumas. And why this is so important is it goes back to that 55-year-old woman. She's the one who really inspired me to do this because it really got me curious. Like I started seeing all these patterns where we're either lying to our parents or we're we're waiting to live our dreams, but we're too afraid to talk to them about it,
yeah.
right? Because we're afraid of that criticism. And so I was wondering, well, why am I so scared? And are these stories that I have true? And so I asked my parents, would you be willing to just talk to me? And I started having these conversations. And I will tell you, they were hard. You know, the first 20 out of the 40 hours, big emotions, a lot of anger, resentment, frustration. I walked out crying. You know, I would go to my husband and like, what am I doing? I'm just going to give up. I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, my parents will never change. And the big shift happened when, so when I started these conversations, I wasn't pregnant and, you know, I didn't have a child. So in the midst of these conversations, I got pregnant. And so we paused the conversation so that my husband and I could return back from overseas to the US, settle down, have the baby. And after I had my baby, I went back and I listened to some of the recordings. And I was shocked because the words I used were fine, but my tone was not nice. My tone was like, oh, you don't know anything. You know, like this very defensive, dismissive tone. And I thought about my child, my baby, my newborn, who's this pooping, crying machine. And I'm like, if he grows up and talks to me like that, how would I feel? And that was the big shift for me because I realized like, I love this child unconditionally. And if he talked to me like that, I would be so hurt. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to my parents like that. No wonder they're not opening up. No wonder they're not, you know, they're not really showing up and you know, they're in their own defenses. And so I changed my mindset. I went into these conversations with the perspective that I'm just going to understand them as human beings. I'm not going to try to change them. I'm not going to try to have them understand me, but I'm going to go in and I'm going to talk to them the way that I hope my kid will talk to me one day. And that's when our conversations really shifted. And when my parents, so the book is, I'm actually still in amazement that my parents are so open to letting their stories be heard because they share a lot of vulnerable things and I published it, their biggest regrets in life, you know, just all of that. So they really, really opened up and now we have this deep, deep connection and a very different relationship.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? I know a lot of people would find publishing an autobiography really, really healing, but they are held back because of the fear of airing their parents' stories, the guilt that comes with it.
Because
it's not just their stories, their parents.
Yeah.
Do you find that healing to tell the world your story and to take stock of what has actually happened?
I think there's two things. The healing actually came from the conversations.
Mm.
They came from understanding my parents' history, the traumas they've been through, their experiences. And I understand them more as human beings. And it doesn't mean that I agree with everything that they did and the way they did it. You know, like my parents abused us. They physically abused us. They beat us up, you know, and like hit us with the feather duster and all that. Right. And they would yell at us and it's not how I would parent my own child. So I don't agree with things that they did. And I also understand why they did it. You know, when you're under that much stress and pressure, no sleep, have three kids to raise, sometimes your emotions are big, you know, and it's hard to regulate. And they did the best with what they knew how to do because that's also how they were raised, right? They just didn't know any better or any different. And so I think that helped heal a lot in terms of me understanding their side of the story, why they did the things they did. And it was also very opening because my dad shared some of his big regrets, you know, and some of the mistakes he made when he was young. And so there is also
a lot for them to say, yes, I've missed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I didn't expect him to say anything, any of that stuff, but he openly shared that. It also was the first time I ever saw my dad cry. I've never seen my dad cry. And so one of the conversations that we had was about my grandpa, who passed away when my dad was young. And he was talking about my grandpa, and my dad started crying. And of course, he tries to hide his tears. But then, you know, I give him a hug, and it just like opens up the floodgates, and he just starts bawling.
Wow.
And I've never seen him cry. And so, like, just the emotional connection to my parents during this journey was healing. And it was healing for me. It was healing for our relationship. But I also think that it was healing for my parents, because now they're completely different. So my dad, he's pre-diabetic, and I couldn't even get him to go for a walk. And now he goes swimming every day, you know, and we live in a place where it's cold in the winter. And he asked me if I could find an indoor swimming pool for him. So he like lugs all his stuff and goes swimming every day because he cares about his health now. And my mom, she was, yeah, you know, like something changed. And for my mom, she in fourth grade was pulled out of school to start working. And so I used to always wonder, why is she so serious? She never jokes. She's never, you know, like joking, playful. And it's because she never had a childhood. But now, like, she actually jokes and is playful. And so I feel like something in them has also shifted. It's healed. And
there's a lot of compassion in the way you speak of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I do. I feel so much love and compassion and empathy and connection.
Has it always been that way? Or has there been a phase of anger?
No. Very easily, no. I moved away from the place that we were born. I was born and raised in Maryland. I left in 2008, and I moved all the way from here to California. And I said, I'm never coming back. I wanted to get out as far away from my parents. Whenever they called me, I'd get so annoyed, and I try to shorten the conversations. You know, like, it was an obligation to talk to them. It was an obligation to visit them. And I felt like I was supposed to versus I want to, which is very different. Like, I should versus I want to. And now I live 10 minutes away from them. I moved back 10 minutes from the, you know, where my parents live. I see them every week. I call them every night. And it's because I want to. It's not because I have to. And when I don't call them, I'm like, oh man, I missed calling them, you know, and it's not an obligation, but I want to talk to them. And sometimes my mom just, you know, goes on and on about the sales and the coupons and, you know, where it's like, and I just kind of laugh. It used to annoy me, and I just kind of laugh because I get it. Why she's like that, you know? And so it's just a very different relationship now. And it is because of those conversations. And I would like to think that, you know, for our parents' generation, they never had the opportunity to share their story.
Mm.
Nobody has ever sat down to say, I just want to listen to your story with no judgment, not trying to change you, right? And so I think because I gave that gift to my parents,
yeah,
they have healed from that because someone actually cares.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think there's, going back to how you had to lie to them when you try to change career, do you think there's something common to the experience of being a child of immigrant when it comes to money mindset? Because I know you've worked on that as well.
Yeah, very much so. It's funny because I work a lot with my clients on money mindset, and there's this notion of, I cannot spend on myself. I must save. I must not spend on myself. I could spend on other people, but not for myself. You know, like this always caring for others and not for me, because that's selfish. So there's this community-based type of mentality too. And a lot of it comes from our parents. But it's so interesting because when I talk to my parents about this conversation around money, they're like, they basically said this, we came with nothing.
It's such a classic thing to say.
Right? Right. We came with nothing. We didn't have the choice to spend money on ourselves.
Yeah.
We did that so you have a choice. Stop being so cheap. That's what they said to me. They said, stop being so cheap. Stop, like, because, you know, when I was working at Google, I was living in New York, and I would still take the bus Because the bus was easy. I was like, oh, and the bus, like, I've got a bus card. It's, you know, it doesn't cost me anything more. Might as well take the bus. And my mom found out I took the bus at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And she's like, are you bananas? You're taking the bus as a woman, like, late. She's like, take a taxi. You know, and I'm like, yeah, but it was $20, you know, $20 for a taxi or just free bus ride. Or I mean, yeah, $20 for an Uber. And she was like, how long do you have to work to make $20? You know, she's like, how long did it take us to make $20? You know, and that $20 was for feeding you. That would have been food money. For you, it's just extra savings that you don't need. And it's your safety on the line, you know? And so, they were like, you know, we did this so you could live a different life, not so that you have to live the way we lived. And that was a big eye opener for me.
How do you feel when you, can you imagine your child doing the same thing and what you might say to them?
I would say the same thing. Like, what are you thinking? Your safety is important, you know, like, and that's what I have to do sometimes is put myself into my parents' shoes.
Right.
And really think about my own child. Like, how would I feel? Like, mm-hmm. And so many of us, I know this among so many children of immigrants where it's, oh, I have to work hard and I must suffer the way my parents did in order to repay them. And if you were in your parents' shoes, would you want your child to suffer to repay you? You know, like you did the thing so your kid could have a different life, not so they could suffer the way you did.
How would you help your clients who just, they may not even be aware that they have been haunted by intergenerational trauma. They just think it's a part of their personality. But clearly they self-deprive and they don't spend money on themselves even when they have to. How do you help them? What are some of the, if they sense that there's something unhealthy about the way they deprive themselves, how do you guide them? Since you do work with people.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the work I do is mindset, and it's about the deeper. It's not the surface level. It's not even about the money. It's what does the money represent to you? What did you learn? We learn our worldviews, our beliefs, our assumptions, our values, all these things were learned. Anything that can be learned can be unlearned. So it's really getting to the core of what does money represent to you? Where did you learn this? What were you taught about it? Right. And how true is that to you today? And taking baby steps, it doesn't mean completely shifting in things, but really seeing, making a shift in how you think about money. You know, for me, it was a long journey for me to see money is not good or bad. It is not, you know, it is a tool. And as a tool, I can use it for certain things. There's a purpose to the money. And to not be afraid of not having enough. And I think that goes back to an earlier question that you posed about intergenerational trauma. And, you know, part of it is the history that many immigrants went through is of scarcity, right? My mom grew up, she had to share a single apple with 5 other siblings, 1 apple for 5 siblings. And that was a treat. And so for her, it was, you don't get special things and there's not enough to go around. And sometimes you go hungry, right? There's just not enough. And so that was just ingrained in her, this belief of scarcity, this fear of not enoughness. And that got passed down. And so it's recognizing, well, what is true for me now? You know, I don't have to share an apple with 5 other siblings. I don't have to, you know, and really understanding, where the source of our beliefs and values and worldviews come from, and then what is mine to hold on to moving forward, and what is mine to let go of. And the other thing is to really think about what kind of future do I want for my kid? Because sometimes we're not willing to make the change for ourselves, but we're willing to change for others, especially our children. And I don't want my kid to carry some of this like anxiety that I had about money. And so how do I want to change that?
Yes. And career too, in terms of shining, it's the same thing, isn't it? It's about stepping into one's brilliance and let honoring one's past and parents without feeling that you've betrayed them.
Yep.
Which is so hard.
Yeah. It's a lot of people I know, because they were taught growing up, what matters in your career is your title, your salary, and that you're moving up, right? And so there's this mentality of, I have to. Like, I actually did a session yesterday with a client, and her belief is, I haven't been promoted in 5 years. That's my next step. And when I posed the question of, well, what makes you think that that's the next step? She's like, because it is. And there's not a certainty of, like, well, why? There, you know, she couldn't explain it. It was because that was just handed to her. And so it really is about exploring, well, where did I learn these things? How did I learn where success is, and what do I want it to mean for me?
Apart from money mindset, career choices, what else do you see are some of the common themes or unfinished business, as you call them, carried by children of immigrant parents or people who are affected by transgenerational trauma without knowing anything?
One of the biggest things is mental well-being and the ability to ask for help. That's huge. And there's this stigma around mental health and asking for help. You have to suffer. There's a Chinese saying, 吃苦, right? You have to eat bitterness. And it's all about, like, how hard can your life be?
It's so vivid. Eats your bitterness,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. which is bizarre. And it was fascinating, because I have a whole chapter on that too, about mental well-being. And my sister, because my sister is a psychologist, and so when she decided to study psychology, my parents' initial reaction back then was, are you crazy? What are you thinking? You're going to, you know, be around crazy people. That's going to make you crazy. But they have completely changed their perspective now. And it is because, and I asked them how that came to be. And it was because they said, growing up back in China and Hong Kong, the only time you go see a psychologist or a psychiatrist is if you are seriously mentally unstable and you go to the psychiatric ward. There was no such thing as a therapist for stress, a therapist for postpartum, right? Like, that just wasn't therapy for what marriage, you know, marriage counselors. It just didn't exist. And they said they didn't have the luxury to have that sort of help, even if they needed it. Like, you couldn't afford that kind of thing. And so they didn't know anything about it. But because my sister went into studying psychology, they watched the news, they read newspapers, and they started learning about all this, right? They're like, yeah, like, it's, if you need help, you should ask for help. And it was so interesting to me, because when, after I gave birth, I started getting postpartum anxiety and depression and, you know, all of those things. And it was my mom who came to me and said, Amy, you need to go get help.
Wow.
She was the one who came to me, and she's like, you're not doing well. You know, I can tell you're not happy. You're crying all the time. Like, you need to go get help. And I was shocked at first. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, I need help, you know, like, and she's like, the hormones from pregnancy. Don't you read the news? Yeah. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I know about it, but I'm so fascinated that, like, they're supportive and she's the one pushing me to do it. And so I think that there is beginning to be a shift in the community, not just my parents. I know my parents are, a lot of people have said, oh, well, my parents would never talk like that. But, like, I think there is generally a more openness to it. And we do, like, there has to be a willingness to be able to ask for help. I think it takes more courage to ask for help than it does to try to, you know, hide behind a mask.
Yes. Wow. I can imagine, as I get questions like that very often, I'm sure you do too. Clients ask them, how long would it take for me to get rid of my burden and break through? I know you can't quantify it, but how would you address that? How long would it take? How many sessions would I be? Would it take for me to be fixed?
So I say a bunch of this. I have a couple of thoughts there. One, it depends on what you're working through. Second is that there's nothing to fix because you're not broken. None of us are broken. We're just human beings, you know, and human beings are perfectly imperfect. So that's the other thing. And the third is life is a journey. There will always be ups. There will always be downs. And there will always be things that feel off that you can work on. Even as a coach myself, I'm working on things. You know, I can see things for other people, but I'm blind to my own things. And I always say as a, you know, coaches are like mirrors. They hold up the mirror so that you could see what you don't see yourself, what you can't see yourself. And also they hold up the mirror so that you will look at things that maybe you just don't like looking at, you know? And as a coach myself, I don't see the stuff sometimes. So I still work with coaches, you know, when I need to. I work with therapists as I need to, because I always say this, we're always a work in progress.
Life is progress and process. It's not a destination to be reached. That's not very go and not very engineering, though.
It's a journey to get there. It's all about the journey. And it's enjoying the journey, because you don't know when the journey is going to be over. And that's something that has been very top of mind for me, too, is like, we don't know how long we have on this planet. So enjoy that journey to get there. Don't rush to get
there. I hear that I'm sure a big part of that, I think, is crucial to your efforts in communicating. But I think your parents are wonderful in the sense that they're open to changing and hearing you. I can imagine that not all parents are like that, and many clients probably have parents who are not open to having a conversation at all, or it would just make it worse if they try to be authentic with them. In these instances, what you suggest them do to deal with the unfinished business?
So I tell people, if your parents are open to having the conversation, great. Then just ask them, would you be willing to have the conversation? If your parents are not going to be open to it, you don't have to ask them permission. You could still ask them questions. So for example, my mom would always call and ask, have you eaten? What did you eat? Right. And so you could throw in when the parent calls, you could say, oh yeah, I had this and this and this for dinner. Oh, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I would eat that same thing that you would make. What did you like to eat when you were a kid? Right. And I always say, start with easy questions like, what did you like to eat as a kid? What was your favorite thing that your parents made for you? How did you like to play? What were your favorite subjects? What were your favorite activities? You know, do you remember a friend of yours? Like, ask easy questions. Don't jump in and say, what was your biggest regret?
Ask them about their lives, you mean?
Yeah, ask them, because the whole point is to get to know them. And I always tell everyone, your goal is to get to know your parents. It is not to change them. It is not to have them understand you.
Yeah.
We always want other people to understand us. We have to understand.
Thinking already of clients who actually are feeling hurt and are at the point where they're dying for their parents to understand them, and they feel very angry towards them and want their own truths to be heard and acknowledged. But then if they tell their parents that, they probably get a lot of defensive responses. So they're feeling quite stuck. There's like this sense, huge sense of injustice. And that's what they call unfinished business, like this ball of anger and injustice doesn't go anywhere because their parents refuse to acknowledge what they have been through. Or even situations where they feel like they had a traumatic parentified childhood, whereas the parents go, well, you know, we tried really hard to put food on the table. You had it much better than us. What else do you want? You call that abuse? Try what we had. And so, you know, their anger are left stuck.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and this is the truth with any relationship. Doesn't matter if it's a friend, a coworker, a parent, a colleague, a child. One person has to be willing to put aside their egos, all their stories and narratives, and actually be the one to say, I want to understand you first. I want to understand why you're feeling the way you're feeling. What is your story? What are your beliefs? Like, what's happening with you? Because if you're attacking them, they're attacking you. No, it's not going to get anywhere. Someone has to be willing to be the one to go first and say, I just want to understand you. And it's not until one person feels understood that they would be willing to try to be open to understanding you.
Yeah. It's so hard to be the bigger person, though, when you feel like you're the victim.
Yeah.
Or coming to wake up to that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I tell people, you need to know why. Why do you want this? And your why should not be, I want to change my parents and I want them to understand me. But why do you want your relationship with your parents to change? What do you want to be different? And I honestly believe that no matter what we say, no matter how far away we try to run from our parents, deep down, all of us still want them to love us and to accept us.
Yeah.
You know, that's core for so many of us. And so if that's your why, like, I want this loving, accepting relationship. I want to be close to my parents. That should be your why going into the relationship, into these conversations. And it's just getting to know your parents. And you start with those easy questions of, what was your childhood like? You know, that's not specific enough. Be very specific in your questions. What did you like to eat? What was your favorite subject? You know, how did you like to play? What was your fondest memory? And so start getting to know your parents. And remember, like, it took me 3 years to get to where I'm at, you know, and there were hard moments, and know that it's not going to be easy. That's why having that why is so important.
Would you ever suggest people to give up and cut off from their parents?
Can you repeat that?
Do you ever suggest people to cut off and give up?
It depends on what they're hoping for. In my perspective, there's so much of this toxic, narcissistic parents, cut off people, set boundaries thing going on. And while I think that the intention is good, it helps people, you know, set these boundaries. And there are true narcissist and toxic people out there. But I think these words are becoming overused, and we're starting to cut off and set boundaries with people that are cutting off important connective ties. And there's actually a research from NIH, and it shows that one of the top risks for estrangement between a mother and her adult child, it's not because of toxicity or narcissism. It is because of a difference in values. So they have different belief systems, and that's why they're cutting each other off.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's, can you have the courage to actually move through and move past the differences in your beliefs and just get to know each other as human beings? You don't have to agree, but there's a difference between, you know, agreeing and getting to know each other as human beings.
Mm. That's beautiful. I want people to know forgiveness is not a requirement. But at the same time, I also think ultimately, if you can come to an understanding and agreement from a loving place, it's much better than holding the resentment and cuts off and then feel like, you know, there's always going to be this big hole. Because with that, it's possible, but it always comes with really a complex mix bag of feelings that could take years to. You.
Yeah. And 100%. And on top of that, it's recognizing that no parent sets the intention of, I want to screw up as a parent.
Yeah.
Right.
Completely.
We all go in trying to be the best we can, and we're all going to mess up. I look at my 2-year-old every day and I say to him, I'm going to do something that's going to mess up. And I hope that you still know I love you and forgive me for it. You know, because I know I'm going to mess up. None of us are perfect. Even with my husband, his mom, he's white American, grew up in a household where his parents were like his perennial cheerleaders. They were always supportive. And his mom always said, you are perfect. That screwed him up. And you would think, how does that screw him up? And it's because he received it as a child as, I love you if you're perfect.
Yeah.
So he would be afraid.
Or there could
to not...
be a lot of coddling with, you know, out of love and kindness.
Yeah. And so that's why, like, we're all going to mess up. And so it's, can we recognize that our parents did the best they could? They're perfectly imperfect human beings, and they messed up.
Yeah.
And it's hard for anyone to admit that they messed up, to apologize. I mean, for anybody who's listening, how hard is it for you to admit when you messed up and to apologize?
It is a complex issue. Yeah. Well, thank you for shedding light on that and sharing your perspective. I think that's something that I want to tread very carefully on. Because I don't want people to feel that they're obliged to have to do the forgiveness route. At the same time, it could be more liberating if you can reach that. Because sometimes holding on to anger, releasing anger and processing anger is great, but holding on to anger for the rest of your life and letting it seep, it is like drinking poison and hoping the other person to die.
Yeah, it is. And you have to think about forgiveness as it's, you're not doing it for the other person, you're doing it for yourself. And you're not necessarily, it's almost as like you're forgiving, you're letting go. That's what I like to see it as. Like, let me truly let go of this. I understand and I can let go.
Yeah. Hmm. What are some other things we could discuss on this topic, do you think? Because I'm aware of time, and thank you so much for sharing these things. We've covered a lot.
One thing that a lot of people ask me is, what if I've already lost my chance? It goes back to that unfinished business. What if my parents are gone? And the thing that I tell them is, are there ways for you to learn about your parents' story, whether it's digging through some of their old things, talking to their, you know, people who might have known them, aunts, uncles, their friends, but really trying to piece together their story so that you have an understanding. The goal of this is really so that you understand their life, their story, and see them as a human being that had these experiences and, you know, have an appreciation for who they are.
Thank you. Have you ever worked with people with unresolved stuck grief where the parents were gone and they couldn't let go?
I have. And it's a long process, and it's around allowing yourself to grieve. So all emotions are sensations, it's energy in the body. Emotions need to come in, they come into your body and they need to exit. If we don't let them exit, what so many of us do is we numb the emotions, we suppress them, but they're still sitting in our bodies as energy, which then results in, you know, inflammation and pains and all these other things. And in moments when we least expect it, those emotions burst out of us. So it really is around giving yourself the time to feel the emotions. And when I say feel it, it means not spinning in your head in the stories, but really feel the sensations. Like, grieve is painful. It doesn't feel good in the body. So it's just sitting with those sensations, letting yourself to fully process it, and giving yourself the time and space to do it. And then it becomes celebrating a person's life.
Mm. I think a lot of people have the fear that once they open the floodgate, it will never get closed.
Yes. And if you suppress it, it's still there.
Yeah.
And it comes out when you least expect it. I had a client who her father passed away 2 years ago, and she's never fully allowed herself to grieve. And there was a moment when her uncle came to visit her, and he said something. It was like her dad's brother, and her uncle said something that all of a sudden just like released all this pain that was in her that she hadn't felt in a long time. And it still sits there, you know, and that's part of the thing is you can be intentional and let yourself release it, or it just pops up when you least expect it. So she ended up bawling in front of her uncle, and she didn't know what to do with that. So
thank you for sharing all that you've shared today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Is there anything you would like to add to our conversation?
I think that's a lot of stuff. I would say, you know, just it's challenging. Humans are challenging and complex. And if we were just to have that empathy and compassion and realize that all of us are going through something and have gone through things and will continue to go through things, then it could shift so much of how we interact and engage with each other.
Thank you for saying that. I used to get anxious about having to come up with some special insights in these conversations with people and then to release them into the world. And then I realized actually the feedback I get is that a lot of people feel pretty healed just from knowing that they're not alone, just from hearing that, just from hearing other people's experience. And they don't have to adopt everything they hear. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you just for sharing your own experience. I think that in itself is a lot.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, have a wonderful day and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for today. Have a good day.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, thank you so much for tuning in. For more, please head to eggshelltherapy.com. There you will find more stories, articles, and resources for people just like me and you. Bye now!
Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Moving forwards, never looking back. Just one more foot in front of all those countless others. And we're there.